His method was profoundly sceptical. He believed that the only possible virtue was true knowledge. He'd tolerate no belief, no hope, that couldn't pass the ultimate acid test. For himself, this meant virtue, but for many of his weaker followers it meant the loss of beliefs and moral habits that would have restrained their impulses. These weaklings became self-accusing, self-indulging scoundrels. Among his young associates were Plato, who afterwards immortalized his method in a series of philosophical dialogues and founded the philosophical school of the Academy, which lasted 900 years. Xenophon of the 10,000, who described his death, and Isocrates, one of the wisest of Greek political thinkers. But there were also Critias, who, when Athens was utterly defeated by Sparta, was leader among the 30 tyrants appointed by the Spartans to keep the crushed city under. Charmides, who was killed beside Critias when the 30 were overthrown, and Alcibiades, a brilliant and complex traitor who did much to lead Athens into the disastrous expedition against Syracuse, which destroyed her strength, who betrayed her to the Spartans, and who was at last assassinated while on his way to the Persian court to contrive mischief against Greece. These latter pupils weren't the only young men of promise whose vulgar faith and patriotism Socrates destroyed to leave nothing in its place. His most inveterate enemy was a certain Anytus, whose son, a devoted disciple of Socrates, had become a hopeless drunkard. Through Anytus it was that Socrates was at last prosecuted for corrupting the youth of Athens and condemned to death by drinking a poisonous draught made from hemlock in 399 BC. His death is described with great beauty in the dialogue of Plato called by the name of Phaedo. Third, Plato was born in 427 BC and he lived for 80 years. In mental temperament, Plato was of an altogether different type from Socrates. He was a most artistic and delicate writer, and Socrates could write nothing consecutive. He cared for beautiful things, and Socrates despised them. He was supremely concerned with the ordering of public affairs and the scheming of happier human relationships, while Socrates, heedless of heat and cold and the opinion of his fellow creatures, concentrated his mind upon a serene disillusionment. Life, said Socrates, was deception. Only the soul lived. Plato had a very great affection for this rugged old teacher. He found his method of the utmost value in disentangling and cleaning up opinions, and he made him the central figure of his immortal dialogues. But his own thoughts and disposition turned him altogether away from the sceptical attitude. In many of the dialogues, the voice is the voice of Socrates, but the thought is the thought of Plato. Plato was living in a time of doubt and questioning about all human relationships. In the great days of Pericles, before 450 BC, there seems to have been a complete satisfaction in Athens with social and political institutions. Then there seemed no reason for questioning. Men felt free. The community prospered. One suffered chiefly from jealousy. The history of Herodotus displays little or no dissatisfaction with Athenian political institutions. But Plato, who was born about the time Herodotus died, and who grew up in the atmosphere of a disastrous war and great social distress and confusion, was from the first face to face with human discord and the misfit of human institutions. To that challenge his mind responded. One of his earlier works and his latest are bold and penetrating discussions of the possible betterment of social relations. Socrates had taught him to take nothing for granted, not even the common relations of husband and wife or parent and child. His Republic, the first of all utopian books, is a young man's dream of a city in which human life is arranged according to a novel and a better plan. His last unfinished work, The Laws, is a discussion of the regulation of another such utopia. There's much in Plato at which we can't even glance here, but it's a landmark in this history. It's a new thing in the development of mankind, this appearance of the idea of willfully and completely recasting human conditions. So far, mankind has been living by tradition, under the fear of the gods. Here's a man who says boldly to our race, and as if it were quite a reasonable and natural thing to say, take hold of your lives. Most of these things that distress you, you can avoid. Most of these things that dominate you, you can overthrow. You can do as you will with them. One other thing, besides the conflicts of the time, perhaps stimulated the mind of Plato in this direction. In the days of Pericles, Athens had founded many settlements overseas, and the setting up of these settlements had familiarized men with the idea that a community need not grow, it could also be made. Closely associated with Plato was a younger man, who later also maintained a school in Athens and lived to an even greater age. This was Isocrates. He was what we should call a publicist, a writer rather than an orator, and his peculiar work was to develop the idea of Herodotus, the idea of a unification of Greece against the Persian Empire, as a remedy for the baseness and confusion of her politics and the waste and destruction of her internecine wars. His political horizon was in some respects broader than Plato's, and in his later years he looked towards monarchy, and particularly towards the Macedonian monarchy of Philip, as a more unifying and broadening method of government than city democracy. The same drift to monarchist ideas had occurred in the case of that Xenophon, whose anabasis we've already mentioned. In his old age, Xenophon wrote the Cyropaedia, a vindication both theoretically and practically of absolute monarchy as shown in the organization of the Persian Empire. Fourth, Plato taught in the academy. To him in his old age came a certain good-looking youngster from Stagira in Macedonia. Aristotle, who was the son of the Macedonian king's physician, and a man with a very different type of mind from that of the great Athenian. He was naturally sceptical of the imaginative will, and with a great respect for and comprehension of established fact. Later on, after Plato was dead, he set up a school at the Lyceum in Athens, and taught, criticizing Plato and Socrates with a certain hardness. When he taught, the shadow of Alexander the Great lay across the freedom of Greece, and he favoured slavery and constitutional kings. He had previously been the tutor of Alexander for several years at the court of Philip of Macedon. Intelligent men were losing heart in those days. Their faith in the power of men to make their own conditions of life was fading. There were no more utopias. The rush of events was manifestly too powerful for such organized effort as was then practicable between men of fine intelligence. It was possible to think of recasting human society when human society was a little city of a few thousand citizens, but what was happening about them was something cataclysmal. It was the political recasting of the whole known world, of the affairs of what even then must have amounted to something between 50 and 100 million people. It was recasting upon a scale no human mind was yet equipped to grasp. It drove thought back upon the idea of a vast and implacable fate. It made men snatch at whatever looked stable and unifying. Monarchy, for instance, for all its manifest vices, was a conceivable government for millions. It had, to a certain extent, worked. It imposed a ruling will where it would seem that a collective will was impossible. This change of the general intellectual mood harmonized with Aristotle's natural respect for existing fact. If, on the one hand, it made him approve of monarchy and slavery and the subjection of women as reasonable institutions, on the other hand, it made him eager to understand fact and to get some orderly knowledge of these realities of nature and human nature that were now so manifestly triumphant over the creative dreams of the preceding generation.